Welcome to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse and help define major global stories. I'm Peter Dobbie. Personalised smart guns have been developed and debated for the past 20 years. The idea is that only verified users can fire the weapon, but the prototypes have been unreliable until now. Smart guns will be arriving in the United States, where promoters hope to avoid tragedies with what they say is gun control. But the implications do not chime with the wishes of the powerful pro-gun lobbies. So could this lead to the US government having the power to regulate the gun market? OK, let's get going. Let's bring in our guest. In Keene, New Hampshire, we have Richard Feldman, the former regional political director, National Rifle Association, and author of Ricochet, Confessions of a Gun Lobbyist. In Oakland, we have Pastor Mike McBride, director of Live Free Campaign and the co-founder of the National Black Brown Gun Violence Prevention Consortium. In Arlington, we have Chuck Nesby. He's a firearms instructor and formerly a naval officer. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Richard Feldman in New Hampshire, coming to you first. Personalized guns, what are the good points and what are the bad points?
Well, the personalized gun being something that is only operational by the authorized user, one can see instances where that would be a very good thing. They were originally developed over 20 years ago, primarily for law enforcement, who from time to time in a scuffle will have their gun taken from them by the perpetrator. And it's, of course, in the interest of law enforcement for the gun not to operate if it's in the hands of the bad guy rather than the good guy. I think we can all see where it would be valuable in certain circumstances. The problems, and thus the downside, is you can't envision all the circumstances, and depending on the technology, it affects the outcome. There was some where it operated off of fingerprints. Well, if you're in a fight and you get your hands in the dirt, the gun wouldn't operate because it can't read your fingerprints. If it works off a battery, what if the battery goes dead in the middle of your scuffle and your gun doesn't operate? So at the end of the day, it's probably the market that's going to determine, is it a valuable tool? Is it worth the tool? There are always costs, benefits, and detriments to everything. And our system usually works things out on a monetary basis. Is it going to be worth the price? And how do the equities balance in the use of the gun?
Chuck Nesby in Arlington. So the technology is not infallible. If we are getting to the point where the technology is A-OK, absolutely trustworthy, will gun owners be prepared, in your mind, to stump up the extra cash? Because these weapons are more expensive than the traditional, still quite simple, 100 years after it went into common usage, still quite simple technology that represents a basic handgun.
Well, first, I agree with everything that your previous speaker just said. Second, the technology is still a long way from being reliable. The guns are going to be very expensive. It's an old technology, about 40 years old. The military has not decided to buy the guns because of reliability and the expense. The law enforcement community, the same reasons, has rejected the gun. And why would the civilian market buy a gun that's extremely expensive and questionable reliability? If the domestic police won't use it, why should the civilian community use it?
Okay, Pastor Mike McBride in Oakland. 90% of teenage suicides in America, the people that kill themselves use a gun. It's a gun that they've got from a relative. It's very easy in America, with 300 million guns in circulation, to go into grandpa's arsenal and get your weapon of choice and end your own life. Would they be a good thing if we just talk about suicide? If we were having a conversation now about suicide, not about gun control, would we be saying this is a great idea?
Absolutely. I do believe we should shift the conversation beyond just conversation around the market or reliability, but we should see smart guns or personalized firearms as a solution to the kinds of accidental shootings, the kinds of shootings involving suicides. It's about ensuring that we have a viable alternative for families and individuals who would like to have a firearm legally, but also ensure that that firearm does not fall into the hands of curious children or underage minors who often are involved in accidental shootings, suicides, or even interpersonal conflicts. And so part of our conversation must expand to, I believe, a public health conversation, not just one that depends on what the military does or what law enforcement personnel may do. The vast majority of gun owners in this country are civilians that need to have public health viable solutions that provide both security and safety at the same time.
Richard Feldman, why are smart guns not as commercialized as perhaps one would assume at this point in the life of people using handguns? They're not as commercialized as one would assume they might be. It's kind of counterintuitive. So where's the dynamic going to come from? Is it the gun lobby, the gun manufacturers, big business, sponsors, or government?
Oh, I think it's going to be the marketplace, and that encapsulates all of those you mentioned. But, you know, I agree with what the pastor just said. You know, it's in our, we have a responsibility to do a much better job keeping guns out of the hands of people who every one of us on this call and every gun owner I know believes ought not have guns. But why would we want to use the most technologically advanced, difficult, expensive system? We can do it right now. They're called gun safes. I'm the guy that with President Clinton back in 1997, when I represented the firearms industry, announced we were going to ship all guns with child safety locks. When you have a gun in the home, why don't we start having people get safes? Safes aren't very expensive, small safes that can hold a couple of guns. We're talking about not $500, $1,000 and up. We're talking around $100. If people, the grandpa who's got his guns, if he left his guns in a safe, his grandkids aren't going to be able to access those guns. It's a simple solution that we can do now for a lot less cost.
Chuck Nesby in Arlington, coming back to you. Has Richard Feldman kind of nailed or pigeonholed the debate there? I.e., it's not a binary decision, despite the fact that candidate Joe Biden was in favor of smart guns when he was on the campaign trail, and Barack Obama was in favor of smart guns. It's not as simple as saying it's smart guns or traditional guns. It's got to be part of a portfolio of reducing the death toll and the inappropriate use of handguns.
Yes, let me say that I totally agree with Mr. Feldman. The Democrat administrations of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama both had studies conducted by the CDC from a health perspective on firearm safety. I want to correct one thing. The number of suicides by firearm is very, very low compared to all the methodologies that are used for suicide. As an instructor, one of the things we cover very detailed is the security of guns, the responsibility with them. Many states have instituted laws that if guns are not secured properly and they are misused, the owner of that gun is held criminally liable. So with good training, we can emphasize the security of firearms, the responsibility that goes with it, and minimize the illegal use of firearms.
Pastor Mike McBride in Oakland, I guess that's a fair point, sir, isn't it? That suicide is suicide, and if somebody wants to take their own life, they will do it. They may do it, they may take a longer time to do it, they may do it in a slightly more messy way, a less surgical way, if you will, but if somebody wants to top themselves, they don't necessarily have to use a gun to do it. But do you get the sense where you are that the NRA is resisting this, despite what the industry is saying? Because the industry is now saying, look, we're getting a better reception from the gun lobby.
Well, I think it's important to just say, while many can use various methods to attempt suicides, the use of guns are the most successful weapons or tools used when suicides do occur, meaning that you may be able to recover from a pill overdose or using razor blades or other forms. But once you pull a trigger, it's very hard to come back from that. And this is, I think, the point. We can't allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. The data says that 37% of deaths could be prevented with these kind of personalized firearms, which means to say that we ought to be thinking about mitigation efforts, ways to ensure that we are reducing the harm, not figuring out 100% fail-safe proof method. A holistic response that includes, I agree, safety locks and other forms of ways to secure weapons ought not be seen as oppositional to personal firearms, because all collectively together, we could indeed increase the number or the percentage of preventable deaths. And that, I think, is the point. In our communities, it is not just about suicides. In the Black community, in urban communities, not just about suicides, but it's also about accidental shootings. It's also about stolen firearms. It's also about the ways in which guns make it into the underground market and then come into the hands of our community members, who are often seduced into using weapons to resolve personal conflict. So the conversation must be expanded, I think, continuously beyond just a 100% fail-safe proof conversation to a public health mitigation conversation that I think will allow many, if not all, of our solutions to work together to achieve the shared outcomes, and that is more safety.
Richard Feldman, is there a sense in which, though, looking forward, smart guns or the enforced deployment of smart guns might be good, in as much as the manufacturing and the use and the availability of particularly handguns is generally a function of boom or bust within the contractual financial side of the industry, i.e., looking at it globally, it depends where the United States is fighting and killing people, and then the contracts, when the United States stops doing that kind of thing or stops peacekeeping, the contracts are then wrapped up with the gun makers, and then there's a surplus of guns on the market in the U.S.
Now, that may have been true, you know, around World War II and before, but civilians buy 20, 30, 40, 50 times more guns in the United States than the military purchases. And the guns the military's primarily interested in aren't available on the commercial market for civilians. They're two separate and distinct markets. So that's not true. And again, you know, I really agree with the pastor. There is no one solution. And when he says, you know, the perfect shouldn't be, or rather the practical shouldn't be the enemy of the perfect. Well, you know, in a perfect world, the smart gun would be the perfect solution. But it's got problems. It will always have problems. And frankly, those gangs could still steal the personalized guns and figure out how to get rid of the personalization. If a gun is in a safe, it can't be stolen so easily without stealing the whole safe or breaking the safe. I mean, sometimes we look for the most incredible solutions when a simple solution will suffice quite well at a much lower cost without all the inconvenience and the debate.
Chuck Nasby.
Sometimes we just like to fight about it.
Pardon me for interrupting you. Chuck Nasby, coming back to you. Would incremental legislation perhaps represent a middle path moving forwards? Because then people who like their guns and the gun lobby, the very powerful political gun lobby, wouldn't feel that they were being presented with this black or white choice of, we're going to take away your traditional guns and you must use the smart guns.
No, that wouldn't work. One, there's a constitutional amendment to our constitution called the Second Amendment that protects the rights of the citizens to own firearms. Second, I agree with the holistic approach. I think that if you make the penalties more difficult, that would cut down a lot of the misuse. For example, if you illegally use a firearm and you're convicted of such in a court of law, mandatory sentencing, say, automatic 20 years. I think that's something the gun lobby would support. And it's also something that would cut down on the illegal use of guns because the bad guys would say the cost is too high.
Pastor Mike McBride in Oakland, is it significant that Johns Hopkins is saying 60% on its website today, they're saying this, 60% of first-time gun buyers would buy smart technology over ordinary technology if it was readily available? Or is it just that they don't know what they're buying, so they just want to go for the latest, glitziest, top-of-the-line handgun with all the technology built in?
I definitely think it is significant because we have begun to win the argument nationally in the gun violence prevention space over and against the gun lobby and gun manufacturers who seem to love to raise straw man arguments about why these things won't work, but are perfectly okay with the carnage and the blood spilling that is happening all across the country with the loosey-goosey over and available use and of firearms. I do believe that firearm consumers are wanting to do their part to ensure that we can literally reduce preventable deaths. Even in this conversation, the idea that one third of preventable deaths could be impacted by these introduction of firearms, smart firearms, it's as if that is a small, insignificant number. We must again allow those with very sensible and committed arguments around protecting and saving and maintaining security around guns. We must allow those arguments to carry the day, and perhaps the industry, the market, the manufacturing of these kinds of smart firearms will grow because the demand will grow, and therein we will have more options. We will have more better technology in this whole sector.
Richard Feldman, just to nail down, if I can, for the next minute or so, what your stance seems to be. The pastor there is saying you can reduce deaths by one third. The lowest state percentage that I found today says you can reduce death by gun by 25%. Doesn't that therefore mean that everyone should embrace the technology and push for the technology to be readily available once it is 100% guaranteed as this functions, it works, it does what it says on the tin?
You know, what you're leaving out of the equation is the people that don't own guns think this new technology is a great idea. The people who own guns and want to own guns don't like the technology for the most part. And it's true. The market will decide. So the people that buy guns aren't interested and don't want it. The people that don't own guns think that the other people who do own them ought to have it. Therein lies the conundrum, because it is the market ultimately that will decide. And the market is of gun owners, not of anti-gun, non-gun owners.
And Chuck Nesby in Arlington, going back to this idea of pro and anti-gun lobbies, does the United States have to disassemble this kind of apolitical metric where you've got this simplistic assumption, Republicans like their guns, it's an issue of free will. Democrats think that everyone's guns should be controlled in a different way, in a harder way, in a tougher way, or even taken away from them?
As an instructor, I can tell you right now, because of the increased crime rate in Democrat-dominated enclaves, that most of my students are liberal Democrats right now that are afraid and looking to defend themselves. There have been several studies that have been done, including the assault weapons ban that went on in this country for 10 years, and several health studies by the CDC that have conclusively said that imposing more restrictions will not decrease and have not decreased the illegal use of firearms. So why we are going through this whole drill again makes no sense.
Pastor Mike, would this dynamic be accelerated perhaps if the equation between adoption and funding was shortened? And the key way to do that is, on the one hand, to get police forces across the United States to start using smart guns. But on the other hand, that's incredibly difficult because you guys in the US, you have so many, you have tens of thousands of individual police forces up and down the country.
And there are 16,000 police departments in this country. And so any kind of universal adoption of any policy is quite Herculean. Again, I would just stress that we must continue in this country to push conversations that are about mitigation, that are about reducing harm. We must continue to shy away from the kind of propaganda and or the lighting our hair on fire about what will not work. It is not true that the kinds of fear-mongering that is happening around crime is actually the reality as it relates to taking guns or owning guns to protect yourself. Again, the research says if you own a gun, you are more likely to have someone in your family or yourself harmed by that gun than by using it in a self-defense type situation. We must expand the consciousness of everyday citizens in this country around public safety, around personal security. And I believe continuing to adopt and introduce these kinds of technological advances can contribute to a conversation where we're not so driven by fear to the point where we are not embracing the kinds of mitigation efforts that can keep us safe.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. We've got to leave it there. Thanks to our guests. They were Richard Feldman, Mike McBride, and Chuck Nesby. That's it for the Inside Story podcast. This episode was produced by Mohamed Elaishi, Usama Aloni, Abdurrahman Wasami, and Paul Taylor. Studio sound was by Nanda Kishore. The program was edited by Anil Anandan, Lynn Nguyen, and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you for listening. We're back again, usual time, on Thursday.